Good evening, everybody. Welcome to Cafe Fox, speak here at Carnegie Science Center. My name is Linda Ortenzo, for any of you who don't know me. The founder and co-organizer of Cafe Fox, it is my pleasure to welcome all of you here tonight. We're very excited about this incredibly unique opportunity. I was joking with Tim before the event, and I said, you know, so many times people really want to tell government agencies where to go and what to do, but tonight we actually have the chance to do it, and they came to us, so they're willing to listen. What's also really exciting is that this is an opportunity for all of you to meet some of our Science Center staff who have tremendous expertise, and it's our chance to show off just a little bit of that this evening. Two of our very fine folks are going to be doing this presentation, and I want to explain to you just very briefly who they are and why they're here, and then they can tell you a little bit about how this evening's going to run and just what you can expect and what we all hope to gain and to give by being here tonight. One of our presenters, Dan Malergo, is the education coordinator for our programs in the planetarium. We have the Buell Digital Planetarium here at Carnegie Science Center. For those of you who may not know or didn't remember, back when many of us were kids, we used to go to the Buell Planetarium over on the north side. Well, this building was built now just about 20 years ago. That facility migrated here to our second floor. And Dan has extensive expertise in astronomy. In fact, if you get the PG, you may have seen his articles. He has two a week. Monday nights, he writes an article called Stargazer. And on Thursdays, there's one that has a new name on your lookout. It's called Next Generation, or My Generation. It used to be called Kids Corner, and it's a science article for kids, but we know that adults like to read it too. Dana has a very special relationship with NASA, and he is very officially, we'll explain this to you, Jet Propulsion Laboratory Solar System Educator. That's a mouthful, and I'm going to let him tell you what that means. But it's because of the relationships that both Dan and John have with NASA that Carnegie Science Center is selected as one of a targeted number of places where this kind of survey is going to take place. So to tell you who John Rizzillo is, he is the director of our division of science education here at the Science Center. He's also an adjunct professor in the physics and astronomy department at the University of Pittsburgh. And also a very unique thing to know about John is that we at the Science Center here have a very strong relationship with our native son astronaut, Mike Fink. Many of you know that he's originally from Pittsburgh. John has a particularly close relationship with Mike, and in fact, was invited by Mike himself to attend the shuttle launch, the shuttle endeavor, which we just found out was pushed back by about 10 days. But by invitation, John and his family are going to be attending the shuttle launch. So with that background and expertise, we're very excited that they were chosen to talk with you tonight about NASA's future plans and give us all a chance to have some input on that. And with that, please help me welcome Dan Lerba and John Rizzillo.
Well, good evening, everyone. Dan and I are going to tag team as we go along here to present the information to you today. As Linda said, this is an unusual event. We tried to think if there was any time that we knew of where NASA had gathered information from the public in trying to determine what they were going to do. We couldn't think of any, so we asked NASA, have you ever done this before? And they said, no, can't you tell? We're doing this at last minute thing, you know, we're excited about it, we're not sure what to do. And so what we're doing is we're turning to places that we have a relationship with and places that do cafe size. And that's the reason Pittsburgh got selected as one of the cities for this town hall meeting. And when I say that they want your input, they really do, and we're going to gather that in several ways tonight. First of all, we have some planetarium staff here who are going to be watching and listening to you closely and writing down what you say and so get a feel for what's going on in the room. We also have another staff member from the Science Center who's actually going to do a video of audio tape of what we're doing. And then during the break, we're actually going to hand out a survey to you that we ask you to fill out as well and return to us at the end. We will be compiling all the data from the survey, as well as the information that we get from the video and from what we observe, and we'll be sending all of that to NASA. So the question is, why are we doing all of this? Why is NASA asking for this information? So let's explain a little bit about what they're after and why this is a planetary science town hall meeting. NASA's Planetary Science Division has a mission to do flybys, orbit, land, road, and return samples from the planets. And their mission statement is up here. It says, advance scientific knowledge of the origin and history of the solar system, the potential for life elsewhere, and the hazards and resources present as humans explore space. Now, I want to clarify what that actually means. What we're talking about here is just planetary exploration. That's what they want to hear about. And of course, right now, how many astronauts go to the planets?
Zero,
right? So this is actually about NASA's robotic exploration of the solar system. They do have a few things they want to say about the exploration of astronauts and how that may tie in, but this is really about robotic exploration. Okay, so they keep that focus. And that is one small piece of what NASA does. In fact, we're going to see numbers a little bit later on. What we're going to be talking about is about 10% of NASA's budget. That's still going to turn out to be a very big number, but that's what they want us to talk to you about. I also want to say that the presentation we're going to do is actually their presentation. That's what they asked us to do. So Dan and I tried to be a little creative and take a few edits here and there, or even we said, oh gee, that's a little tough. We'll save that one. But we tried to stay true to the presentation to give you the information they want you to hear. Okay? So with that set up, let's explain what a field survey is, because that's at the heart of the presentation today. Once every 10 years, NASA, the National Science Foundation, makes a request to the National Research Council. The National Research Council actually goes out and does a survey of the planetary science community. They say, look, all you people who have gotten grants from the government, researchers at universities, we want to know, how did the last 10 years go? What did you do your research on? What do you think we learned? And what does that lead you to think the next big questions are, and how would you like to see resources spent over the next 10 years? Now, they actually do this type of survey in other areas of science as well. There's an earth science survey, within the physics area, there's a survey as well. But in NASA, it's only about planetary science missions. Some people have asked NASA why the National Research Council doesn't do a decadal survey specifically on human spaceflight. And right now, NASA's not interested in that at the moment. But I think that's a good question. Maybe that's something that we might suggest that they do down the road. But right now, they only do it for the planetary science piece. Now, the detailed survey involves broad participation from the planetary science community. Throughout the presentation, you hear Jeff, Dan, and I talk about input from the community. In this presentation, when they talk about input from the community, they're not talking about you. The presentation is about the science community. This is about what they have gathered from the scientists. This was part one, the first phase of this. You are part two, going out to town halls, to cities and towns all across the United States, and asking for your input. I just want to clarify that. Primary scientific input that NASA and NSF used then comes from this survey, and then NASA has to respond to the survey and craft their own 10-year plan. So NASA takes the information from the survey, they're going to take the information from you for the first time, and they're going to come up with their own 10-year plan for exploration. And when we say 10-year plan, by the way, just to clarify, this covers the period from 2013 to 2022. That's the period of time that NASA is talking about for their programs.
And all this information we're presenting to you tonight is available on the Decadal Survey website. You'll get that website. It'll be on in our presentation. It'll also be on the surveys. The last slide showed this Visions and Voyages. It's a 140-some page report. Fantastic reading about our current knowledge of the solar system. It's available on that website, as along with these PowerPoint presentations as well. So it's there for you to enjoy and read as well.
If you go to that site, you'll actually discover that they also videotaped and audio-taped all of the official meetings that were part of the survey process. And they also have transcripts of all those meetings. So if you really want to know the details about how this study was done, how this data was collected, you can actually watch, listen to, and read hours and hours of information about it. It's quite impressive what they've gathered there.
Each one of those missions on the screen have documents that you can read on the website.
Okay. So let's tell you a little bit about the guiding principles for the survey. This is what was laid out. They said, look, for this process, science must come first. All recommendations must be first and foremost science-driven. Now, a Of course, that might seem obvious to everyone, but of course, you know, everybody's got to watch out for their own. Universities might want to be interested in certain projects that they have a particular area of expertise in, they'll need the research funds. That's a normal part of the process. But they said, no, you have to be able to justify everything on the science first. Community involved in the science community, solicit input throughout the process, and you'll see that they certainly did that. And then transparency and openness make the process as open and visible to all interested members of the community as possible. And that's the reason that all of the minutes, all of that data has been put online for anyone to take a look at. Now, there was actually a statement of task that governed what had to be done here. The statement of task was provided by NASA, the National Science Foundation, and had input from the Office of Management and Budget. So you'll see us talking about numbers later on. That's going to be an important piece of this process. We want it to be realistic about the dollars, and you'll see what we mean in just a minute. Statement of task emphasized that our recommendations should be science-driven. We commented on that already. And it also placed a strong emphasis on recommending a plan that can be carried out in full using the funding that's available. Now, these decadal surveys actually go back to the late 60s, and there has been a tradition of carrying over missions into each window. So as you start each new 10-year period, you're usually carrying over the first 5 years of that 10-year period. You're taking care of missions that started before. To some extent, that can be helped. But one of the things they were trying to say is, look, let's look at the money we have, the window we have now. Let's see if we can give some priority missions that could be completed as close to being in that window as possible, and certainly within the dollars that are allotted. Not say, well, I'll know I'll get more money in the next 10-year cycle, so we'll just let the mission slide. They said, let's try to avoid that. That was one of their guiding principles. Community organization, they wanted you to see how this was arranged. And there's an interesting lesson in here, because when you see the arrangement that was created for the organizing committees, you see a little bit of what their interests really are. So you see that there's a steering group, and you see the chair and vice chair that was, and nine other individuals there. But then you see five specific panels related to inoplanets, outerplanets, primitive bodies, we'll talk about what that means in a second, Mars, got a committee all by itself, and outerplanet satellites. They said these five areas of research were distinct enough that they wanted all the filter and all the discussion to happen through these five areas. Okay? We'll see how the kind of rules they came up with in the areas that they talked about wanting to look at fit these five different paths. Input from the community. Okay? So the goal, of course, as we said, is to seek out the community's view, build a consensus. And they did that by having cross-referencing among all these communities. You looked at your own area of science, but then you also had people from other committees looking at your review in your area, the steering committee looking at everyone's review, so they were trying to get everyone to have buy-in. They held more than a dozen town hall meetings. Now again, this was the first phase of the process. Not these town hall meetings, but town hall meetings specifically for scientists. And you see this sort of NASA alphabet soup of some of the groups that were involved. The American Geophysical Union, Lunar Planetary Science Conference, the Division of Planetary Science, the European Planetary Science Congress, and on and on. So these groups were all invited to participate in the town hall meeting process. And then they asked for white papers. They asked researchers to submit position papers on what they thought the most promising areas of research should be. As it turned out, in the end, 199 white papers were submitted. And they were submitted by 1,669 individual authors and endorsers. So sometimes an entire institution or a department might sign on to a proposal. Other times it was people who were interested in a particular area of research, so it might represent many institutions, but they submitted the paper together, and that's why we had such a large number of people involved. White papers were one of the main inputs for the process, and many white paper authors were then later invited to come and present to the specific panel. So if you wrote a white paper about Mars, that's what you were interested, you might very well have been invited to one of the meetings of the Mars panel to further explain your proposal, do a little Q&A, make a pitch for what you're really talking about. Open sessions meetings, we said this already, but the webcast has been put online. And then the draft report was reviewed by 18 peer reviewers. That's outside of the community process. So lots and lots of people looking at this. What emerged from the process? NASA clearly saw some cross-cutting themes. So three areas were identified as themes for planetary science from this study. And they collectively decided to apply these themes and these sort of definitions. One was building new worlds, which is about understanding solar system beginnings. Planetary habitats, searching for the requirements for life. And workings of the solar system, revealing planetary processes through time. The report expands on these themes and identifies key scientific questions for each. So we want to talk about each of these themes a little bit, and maybe also read between the lines a little bit about what they're really trying to get at with each of these categories, each of these themes. Let's talk about building new worlds a little bit. These are the questions that they released. What were the initial stages, conditions, and processes of solar system formation, and the nature of interstellar matter that was incorporated? So, what are the early processes like? A lot of research that's happening now in planetary science connects to research that's happening in other areas of astronomy. One of the big areas of research has been looking for how other solar systems are forming around other stars. This is about making a connection between what we have here in the one solar system we know well, the one where we can actually do some active research, and what we can see at a distance is happening in other solar systems, and see if we can find similarities and parallels and the differences in those processes. How did the giant planets and their satellite systems accrete? And is there evidence that they migrated to new orbital positions? One of the mistakes that we've made throughout history of science was to assume that we were special. We've done that over and over and over again. I think we've started to get the idea, right, that the way the rules work is what we see here should be what we see everywhere else. That the rules that apply here in terms of basic science should be the rules that we find in another solar system, on the other side of the galaxy, in another cluster of galaxies, and so forth. So they take a look at the research that's been done, knowing the limitations, and say, look, well, we look at our solar system, and we see a very clear divide of small, rocky inner planets, large, gaseous outer planets, and we see a close connection with the outer planets helping the inner planets to develop. Basically, Jupiter all by itself serving as a shield, protecting the inner planets from bombardment. Not that we haven't had our share. That's been a key factor, we think, in the evolution of our solar system. Yet, when we look out at other solar systems, we find that that arrangement does not hold in all cases. In fact, more often than not, we find large gaseous planets very close to their star. Now, some of that we know is a limitation of our techniques, but it's happening enough, even as the techniques get better, that people are starting to say, well, are we missing a step in between? Could it be that planets, giant planets form in a different place and move? Maybe they come out and go in, maybe they go in and come out, but what's going on with that? So again, there's a connection between what we see here in our solar system and the research that's going on in other areas of astronomy. Which, if you think about it, in terms of how we'd like to see dollars used for research, it makes a lot of sense. They're thinking about what everybody else is doing too, and not just looking at their own area. Actually, I should say one more thing about that, because Dan will poke me if I walk too close to the line. Because we are doing this as NASA representatives, you will not hear us say, oh, this is a great mission. I think you should write that down. Did you write that down? Yeah, I think that is. Or call your congressman and tell him not to fund us. We can't do that, no matter what we think. Or at least Dan can't do that, because he's this public system of education.
Oh, I can't talk about past great missions. For example, what you're looking at right here is a particle from a comet. The mission just completed, it was stardust. It flew into the coma of a comet, captured dust particles, and brought them back to Earth. Amazing mission. So I can talk about past missions.
And we'll make some connections with those as we go along. But we don't want to advocate for a particular area, but I think it's fair to say, to point out, that the research does connect across lines, and I think that's a good thing. It shows they did their homework. What governs the accretions of water chemistry and internal differentiation from the inner planets and the evolution of their atmospheres, and what roles did bombardment by large projectiles play? What does that all boil down to? That's all about home, right? That's what they're really getting at. How do you get Earth-like worlds. And again, that connects to the research that's happening in other areas of astronomy. So what can planetary exploration in our own solar system bring to that puzzle? Right now, there are missions going on. In fact, we have Pittsburgh Connections, the Kepler mission, for example. The mirror for that particular spacecraft was made by the Shear Corporation from Pittsburgh, and it is racking up discoveries of small planets now, planets that have the potential to be Earth-like. We're looking for Goldilocks worlds. The world is just one, just like us. Again, this is the sort of bridge between what's happening in other areas of astronomy research and what can happen in planetary science exploration. So if you read between the lines, you can see a little bit of what's going on with that. This continues in this next theme of planetary habitats. So what did you have for sources of organic matter? Where does organic synthesis continue today? So if we take a look at our solar system, can we see either places in the solar system where we know the first stages of the formation of organic material, the formation of life, may have happened in the past, where it could be happening now? Could we find evidence of that, and how does that connect back to what's happened here on Earth? So again, it's about looking for life in the universe by what we can do with our research here. So, you see, did Mars or Venus host ancient aqueous environments? Then they have oceans. Right? We think there's very good indications, certainly for Mars, that this was the case. We think for past missions, maybe I'll speak to that in a second, about past missions that have shown us that that was the case with the environment. So, if you have the potential, you have the environment where you could have early life, is there evidence that life did in fact emerge? Just because you have the conditions doesn't mean that you got it. But if you don't have the conditions, right, then we can't talk about life in the solar system. And I should say, by the way, of course, whenever NASA is talking about life in the solar system, it is perfectly fine to talk about sort of edges of exploration of life and talk about the possibility of life being very different from us. So, for example, could you find silicone-based life? Could you find life that used liquid methane instead of water in the biological processes that we use? NASA is interested in those kinds of things. But in almost every case where you see them referring to the processes of life or looking for signs of life, you can fill in the line, life as we know it. That basically, organic material, carbon-based material as we know it, energy supplies as we recognize them, life that would look something familiar to us when we saw it on the first glance.
And this top slide here is actually that organic matter. It's methane lake on Saturn's largest moon, Titan. Give you a size comparison, it's about the size of Lake Superior. This was recorded and imaged by Cassini.
Okay, and beyond Earth, are there modern habitats elsewhere in the solar system with these necessary conditions? We're talking about organic matter, water, energy, the nutrients to sustain life, and do organisms live there now? So when we talk about the research for life, we're not just talking about finding evidence for the existence of past life, potentially on Mars, certainly maybe on Venus, but are there locations in the solar system where there might be life going on right now?
Europa, right there. This is Jupiter's moon Europa, and we think there's an ocean of salt water under the surface.
Third big category, workings of solar systems. How do giant planets serve as laboratories to understand the Earth, the solar system, and, I referred to this earlier, extrasolar planetary systems? So how do we make the connection between what's happening here, the giant planets we see here, what we see happening around other solar systems? What solar system bodies endanger and what mechanisms shield the Earth's biosphere? Big area of interest in the workings of the solar system. How did we survive the environment? How did we get through the bombardments? What changes were made? And what are the risks that still exist? One of the things that really has become clear over the last 30 years is that the history of the Earth has been extremely mild. At least a dozen major extinctions, and at least half a dozen of those probably caused by asteroid impact that we are able to see in our planet's record, historical record. So, what are the chances of that happening again? How can we guard against that? What research can we do about that? And that's one of the areas that NASA is interested in. They want to also understand the roles of physics, chemistry, geology, and the dynamics of driving planetary atmospheres and climates. And they tell you right there why. to get a better understanding of climate change on our planet. A lot of people don't realize, when we talk about climate change and the evidence for climate change, a huge percentage of that, that majority of the data that we have that supports climate change, was in one way or another actually gathered by NASA. And so NASA has played a major role in gathering this information. This is a major topic of research for them, and they're saying this is an area that they'd like to see continued. And how have these processes shaped the solar system, operated, interacted, and evolved over time. So it's an ongoing process. One of the things that we know is that the way we see the world today, the way we see the solar system today, the way we see the universe today, is not the way it was yesterday, and it's not the way it will be tomorrow. So how do those changes occur? Do we affect those changes? Can we affect those changes? How do we keep an eye on what's happening for our own survival, our own interests in the world as well? So, those themes lead to specific missions, as Dan started to say. He's going to take you through these in just a second. Based on science identified by these white papers, these categories that were sorted out, 25 mission candidates were chosen. Many, many more were there, right? Many will enter, few are chosen. 25 selected, okay? And studies were performed by the NASA offices on each of these. There was a study team for each of these missions. At least one science representative from the appropriate panel had to be there, but you also had to have people from other panels. So again, as I said, if you're interested in those asteroid impacts, if that's the category, that's the mission that you're going to take a look for, you have to have at least one representative from that other small bodies group who's going to take a look at that, but you also want input from other groups. Because you have to justify to them the value of the mission. Considerable time and effort, that's certainly true. And all the study reports, as we said earlier, all this information is out there, all the study reports on each individual mission are posted on the website, and they're also included in the final survey report. So you can take a look at all that data and see what they said about each of these missions. Now, part of what they're doing for this evaluation process is a cost and technical evaluation, okay? So you take a look at the scientific aspects, right? But high priority mission candidates were also given a cost and technical evaluation, a CAPE by the Aerospace Corporation. These estimates are based on multiple factors that they're looking at, including actual costs from similar past missions, right? As well as what they're saying they think the costs will be, right? And you always have that inherent optimism. You want to avoid that. When you tell them you think this is going to cost, we'll also look back at similar missions and we'll multiply by a factor of 10, right? Because that's usually what happens. Okay? And of course, that results in some sticker shock. But realism is essential, right? So they're trying to make financial estimates and decide where are we going to get the biggest bang for the buck. They're interested in where are we going to get the most scientific impact, the most data back, with the lowest level of risk for the least amount of dollars. That's the equation they're always trying to work. Now, in any particular mission, you may say that what you're trying to get at, the data you want, is so worthwhile, you're willing to spend a little bit more, you're willing to take a little more risk. So I'm not saying that there aren't some missions that go in that direction. But as a whole, they're trying to come up with a formula that says, how are we going to spend these dollars in such a way to get the most we can across all of these areas, okay? Now, talk a little bit about those cost pieces in just a second. But let me give you the prioritization criteria that they put in there on the list. So science return per dollar, I just mentioned. Programmatic balance. They want all of those themes represented and all of those communities represented. Now, in the past, they certainly tried to do this, but we haven't always had terrific balance. For example, if you want to look at the last 10 years of research, you'll find a tremendous number of Mars missions. That was by design, and they could certainly do that in the next 10 years. But they're saying one of the things they want to do is they may be some prime targets where they want to put a lot of missions, but they do want to try to find some balance. Technological readiness. You may come up with a great mission, but if you say, and magically we'll have the technology to do it, you're probably going to go down a little bit on the priority list. If you can point to something and say, hey, we have off-the-shelf technology that has flown, that has been tested, we We know we have engines of the right size. We know we have hardened technology, electronics that have been used before. That's something that will move the priority up a little bit. Okay? It makes it more likely that you can pull this off. And then availability of appropriate trajectories. This is something that people don't think a lot about. I cover this with my students in the basics of space flight. Everybody thinks a little bit of science fiction, right? Here we have a spacecraft, it's going to Jupiter, let's go, right? Space to Jupiter. If only, right? The fact of the matter is that to do the simplest paths to get to places requires huge amounts of energy, which means that you're going to need big engines and lots of fuel, which raises the weight of the vehicle, which means that you need even bigger engines and more fuel. You can see we have no problem that happens there very quickly. The shortest path is usually not possible. It's not realistic in terms of the vehicle we have designed. So instead, what you need to do is use gravity and do transfer orbits that take paths that the spacecraft can follow much more easily with much less fuel used, smaller engines. But when you do that, you're going to take a longer time to get there, and you're going to need to have the planets in the right places, or your other targets, if you're going for an asteroid or a comet, in the right places at the right time. You're looking at this 10-year window, and you can't find a realistic path. You might just have to say, well, I just don't have that window coming up in the next 10 years. We might have to wait a little longer for this. So that's a realistic consideration. You can't always go where you want to go when you want to go. One of the rules of space flight. Okay. Process. All priorities and recommendations were guided by the community inputs. We talked about that. Okay. Within the subject area, you have to prioritize as well. So you don't want balance across the areas, but within the given area. So you're going to take a look at moons, outer planets in the solar system, and you've got a mission that's out there, and you've got several possibilities. That panel is going to weigh in on which of those get the highest priority. Cross-panel prioritization, great, everybody gets to do that, and then the steering committee takes a look and says, well, you know, justify to us why you're prioritizing that, right? We might make some changes as we go along, okay? And then, of course, the final recommendations arrive by achieving consensus. So hopefully you'll be filled in the room, and you come out with an understanding where people can say, I can support that, even if that wasn't my first choice. That's what they're going for. They don't want any of these, you know, 15 people on the committee, and then you're going to have 8-7 vote on every mission. If they've done that, they failed, right? They want to be able to have broad consensus where most people can support what's happening, and that's what they're trying to do with this survey. Okay. And then it all has to fit. We talked about the money. This is the money wedge. Okay. Remember we said that the Office of Management and Budget was tied in here. I don't know how clearly you can see this, but basically, they did all their estimates on the value of fiscal year 2015 dollars, and they plotted out for you here from 2011 to 2022. Remember, with 2013 being the first year of the new decade, what the cost would be for emissions that already exist, and how much money they think they're going to have. So if you take a look over here, in 2011, what we are up here is about $1.5 billion, climbing out to 2022, getting close to about $1.9 billion, or about 10% of the whole NASA budget ask. So if you look at NASA's budget as a whole thing, say, wait, 10% is their planetary exploration? NASA does a lot of other things. Okay? They do the human exploration missions. Okay? They do all the aeronautics research. They have overlap and responsibilities in the areas of defense that they pay for as well. There's research and development areas. So the actual amount of money that goes to these planetary solar system missions is only 10% of the entire NASA. And the entire NASA budget, by the way, just to put it in perspective, has run, basically since 1970, has run at about 0.5% of the federal budget, give or take. It's gone up, down, small amounts, but that's roughly the range. So that's what they think they have here, okay? And here are all those other missions, ongoing things, winding down from the previous 10 years, right? So even as we get to 2013 here, look what's happening in that very first year. They're saying,
this amount of money here, $1.1 billion, is just going for what we already have left over from the last 10 years. Here's the new money we can spend. And of course, as the decade goes on, those missions wind down, those costs wind down, and we have more and more money available in order to do the new things we want to do. This is what they were talking about when they said, stay within the estimate. I want to be very clear, there is no guarantee that this is the money they will get. We don't even have a budget for the current fiscal year they got, right? In fact, if you see the impact on this, NASA is talking about two more space shuttle missions. Mike Fink goes up in April, they're supposed to be the final mission in June. That mission's on the books, they're preparing for it, they don't have a dime for it, because it's in the new budget. Okay? This all comes back to the political process. The Office of Management Budget saying, well, here's what we think you can ask for based on previous years, here's what we think is going to happen, here's the growth we think we see, or the shrinking that we think we see, here's what's going to happen, and then it's got to go through the democratic process. The budget has to be passed. So until the budget is passed, no dollars are real. So they understand that. They're working with their best estimates they can get, but it's not real until they actually get voted on. And of course, that happens with every budget in the 10-year cycle. Right? So it's not just like, oh, okay, here's the 10-year budget. They passed it, yay, we're all set for the next 10 years. No, that's 1 year. And then you go and fight that all over again in the second year. So that's what they mean by estimates. Year by year, you have to see what you're actually going to get. Okay. Can you talk a little bit about the specific missions?
And these are some of the missions that were approved and paid for in the last annual survey. And of course, the mission that just made news last week, Messenger finally went into orbit around Mercury after 6 years. Three flybys, we're now in orbit. The Venus Express supported
in 6 years and three flybys. That's what we mean by trajectory, right?
Venus Express, supported by the European Space Agency, sponsored by European Space Agency, supported by NASA, JPL, Deep Space Network, Communications, is currently exploring Venus. Two missions that have come to an end are the Epoxy, which you remember the previous name, Deep Impact, when we flew a copper impactor and it crashed into a comet. We wanted to find out what the structure, the composition of the comet was. And the Stardust Next mission, which just finished up operations March 25th. It burned the remainder of its fuel. It was the mission that brought back comet samples and just recently flew by Comet Temple. Comet Temple was the mission that Deep Impact sent the impactor into. We didn't get a chance to see the crater that was made from the impact, because by the time the space probe, the mothership, flew by the crater, the dust cloud didn't get a chance to settle. So we recommissioned Stardust, called Stardust Next, and just sent back pictures, rendezvous with Comet Temple on Valentine's Day. And on March 25th, we burned the remaining fuel. Rosetta is a European Space Agency mission that we support through the Deep Space Network. Through instruments that NASA provided, it's going to rendezvous with a comet, explore a comet. Hayabusa was a successful Japanese mission that actually brought back dust particles from an asteroid. It was a sample return mission from an asteroid. And if you go to the Japanese Space Agency, you can read all about that successful mission. Dawn is about to make news. It has a very unique propulsion system, ion propulsion. It's going to rendezvous with the asteroid Minor Planet Ceres this summer. And then it's going to fly off to Vesta and travel to Vesta, rendezvous with Vesta in 2014. Where am I at? This is the first time we've actually been able to use a space probe, explore one planet, one object, orbit it, and then fire our engines, get out of orbit, and travel on to another object. First time in history, made possible by ion propulsion. Jupiter, the mission's going to be launched this August, is Juno. We're going to be exploring Jupiter's atmosphere and its core. Some scientists think there's an icy core in Jupiter. Cassini-Huygens, you're all familiar with Cassini, the breathtaking images that's bringing back every day, and exploring not only Saturn, but its moons like Enceladus. We see these ice geysers, and we're exploring the rings. And of course, the Huygens probe, some scientists call this one of the important moments in space exploration, is when we landed the Titan, a lander on the surface of Titan. And of course, our mission to Pluto, the New Horizons. The middle of 2015, so it's a 9-year journey, launched in 2006. We'll rendezvous, fly by Pluto, not orbit, fly by Pluto in 2015, and then explore some other Kuiper Belt objects.
And yes, Pluto is still there, in spite of what you heard.
There are two satellites in orbit around Mars, the Mars Odyssey and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. These two satellites, space satellites, are actually imaging the surface. The images from these two satellites helped us land the two rovers, the Mars Exploration Rovers, Spirit and Opportunity. Unfortunately, we may be saying goodbye to Spirit. Got stuck in the sand over a year ago, wasn't able to position its solar panels to the sun, and probably the batteries probably went dead. The NASA was going to give it until April, and if it doesn't receive a signal or respond to signals, we're probably going to officially declare it dead. A successful mission that concluded last year was Phoenix, thanks to the imaging from Odyssey and Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter. We recognize the fact that there's enough ice buried beneath the surface of Mars to fill up all flight Michigan. And Phoenix proved that. It landed in the northern polar region, dug a trench under the regolith, under the dirt, and there it was, ice, frozen water. Mars Express, a European Space Agency mission that we also support. And the Mars Science Lab, this is the next rover that's heading to Mars. It'll be launched in November. It'll be nuclear powered. And it's, you talk about science fiction and the next century of technology. Instead of using a rock abrasion tool to scrape away some of the surface of the rock, this rover, about the size of a Mini Cooper, will have a laser beam. It'll be able to blast the rock and then analyze the gas and dust, the dust released from the rock. And that's only possible with power. And then finally, launched in, once again, these missions we've supported, we have money for them. It was already committed in the last decadal survey. MAVEN will be launched towards the end of 2013. It'll explore Mars' atmosphere. So these are some of the missions that we are supporting now. And this is where all those missions fall. And this is our funding and support with the European Space Agency right there. However, recently, right before the cable survey was released, the Office of Management and Office of Budget Management from the White House gave NASA some disappointing news. As you can see, the numbers, our current budget, $1.3 billion, and we are hoping for $1.4 billion in 2012, but look what's happening to the budget over the next 5 years. Increasing every year.
So remember, 1.5 was the starting point on that initial graph from OMB. This drops, takes that 1.5 and starts going down instead of up.
We were hoping to go up with the budget. And with compromise and talks that are going on in Washington right now, it looks like we may be getting less for NASA's space exploration budget. So here's the recommendations now. These are the recommendations that the committees have come up with on each one of the different programs. Increase NASA's planetary research and analysis budget by 5%. Improve the total by fiscal year 2011.
So host Quincy Turner. You're saying 5% in the first year and then 1.5% after that.
One of the most important things is technology development. When I talked about ion propulsion, I had a chance 3 years ago. I was touring Boeing headquarters in Houston, where the neutral buoyancy lab is. They actually have a laboratory there where they're experimenting with ion propulsion. One of the problems with ion propulsion is you can't accelerate or decelerate it. They are working now on trying to adapt ion propulsion for future space missions where they can actually accelerate and decelerate. This is ongoing experimentation right now. Technology development should be funded at a 6-8% level of NASA's total planetary science mission budget.
So one of the things they're pointing out here is that in the past, when you had a cut, technology development took a hit very often. And here the recommendation is protect that piece of the budget even if you have to cut other places. They're going to make some recommendations where they think you could cut. They're saying protect the technology development this time. We didn't do such a great job of that last year.
So there's three basic types of missions. The first, the fastest, cheapest, and faster, cheaper, and faster, better, is the Discovery mission. These are missions that usually cost under $500 million, like Deep Impact, or missions like LaCrosse to the Moon, or the Kepler telescope. This was Genesis, a sample return from the Sun. And this is the Stardust sample return capsule, which, by the way, is in the Smithsonian Institution right now. It's recommended that we continue the Discovery program. We put a cap on the total spending to about $500 million by fiscal year 2015.
That's cheap, $500 million missions. That's the low budget missions.
There are no recommendations made for the Discovery missions right now. However, we do, we are going to be supporting Mars Trace Gas Orbiter.
So one of the things they're saying in this category is they're going to let NASA make the selection. They want the Discovery mission to happen, let them prioritize. So the survey does not say which order these should happen.
Now the second mission you're familiar with is the cost a little more, the $1 billion mission, the New Frontier program. And of course this is New Horizons. And this is the Juno mission, which will be launched in August. These are high priority missions, and they have a little more capability than the Discovery missions. And there are some recommendations. We still have to, we're still looking this, for New Frontiers 3, and then we have a group of missions that we're going to select for New Frontiers 5. No particular recommendations. However, these are the missions. Common Surface Sample Return Mission, Lunar Stock Pole Sample Return, a Saturn probe, Trojan Tour, the asteroids that are in the Jupiter's orbit, and a Venus lander, Venus Institute to explore. The three missions that are up for the NF3, the New Frontiers 3 mission, are the Comet Sample Return, the Lunar Stock Pole, and the Venus Lander. And when we choose one of those missions for the New Frontiers 3, then whatever's left on the list, we'll pick for New Frontiers 4. And then when we pick New Frontiers 4, They've added three more missions, two more missions, an IO observer and a lunar geophysical network. Once again, there are no priorities. These missions will be picked by the NASA administrative office.
So they say these are $1 billion missions, right? These are the big missions. You're going to have five selections. You're carrying two over. You've got a third option that's already in the pipeline to get a choice from. We're suggesting two more be added in this 10-year sequence. And what they were really outlining there is the process for choosing. We're giving you a list of what we think the top priorities are, but in no order. So from this list pick, you basically pick one for the first category, then you've got to move to go for the next one. Pick your next one, then you've got another one. We've done all that. We'll give you two more choices at the end. Make your third pick.
And the last mission are the flagship missions, and there is one primary recommendation, and that's the Mars Astrobiology Explorer Cashier, which is a sample return mission.
Flagship missions, I'm just going to say, just what they sound like, these are the grand missions. These are the multi-billion dollar missions. You can do a lot in those other categories, but these are the ones where you have the most scientific equipment, usually the longest runtime, the most science that you're going for in the course of the mission.
Other missions that are recommended are the Jupiter Europa orbiter, a Uranus orbiter probe, and an Enceladus orbiter for Venus climate mission. Now, once again, the primary priority is MAXC, which is the Mars sample return mission. Now, the problem with this mission is it costs a lot of money. In order to get this mission to be a go, we need to de-scope it. We need to trim the costs. And what NASA's saying is the cost estimate for MAXC is $3 to $5 billion, $3.5 billion. However, it needs to be de-scoped and brought down to a range of $2.5 billion. Now, de-scope missions doesn't mean it's going to be not as successful. If you remember, the two Voyager probes, they're both de-scope missions. So we can still get a lot of science return by trimming money from the missions.
Now, I just want to point out the reason that MAXC rises to the top on the Mars mission and why they're recommending that one is they say that flotilla of ships we sent over the last couple of decadal surveys said, look, we've got a tremendous amount of data we want to build off that, but we don't see the next big scientific advance in Mars study that brings something back for research. So that's why this one rises to the top. This is something you couldn't do in any other way. You can push Mars research forward, and Mars research can spend a lot of money on it. This is what you have to do.
So MAXC is the priority, however, if it can't be brought down, if the cost can't be brought down, then they recommend saving it for another decade and pick a mission from the others for about $2.5 billion. Once again, those other missions are a Jupiter Europa orbiter, a Uranus orbiter, or an Enceladus orbiter. Enceladus is the icy moon of Saturn, which has actually shown ice geysers, so that's why it's one of the other missions chosen for our flight.
And that recommendation is just what you do at home, right? Right. You've heard somebody say, you can't do the kitchen right, let's put it off in a few years. That's what they're saying. We'll let you, let the de-scope go so far, but if you can't pull that off, can't do it in that window, you're going to have to let it slide. You'd rather see that happen and have it come back again than do it in our age. It doesn't make sense.
And the reason why we are picking the Europa mission is because it's probably one of the best candidates in our solar system beyond Earth that might have microbiotic life, some form of habitable environment in the oceans under the icy crust. And once again, this is another expensive mission too, estimated right now $4.7 billion, and it's also too expensive to carry out with the current funding. So it also needs to be scoped if we were going to pick this mission over the Mars mission. The last priority would be the Jupiter orbiter and probe. Once again, this is another expensive mission. One of the reasons why we're choosing here it is because we called recently we called the two outer gas giants icy world, the icy gas giants. There's a potential here for new discoveries comparable to what Galileo discovered at Jupiter and Cassini discovered at Saturn. Now, Uranus is preferred over Neptune primarily because of trajectory. It's a more favorable trajectory to go to Uranus.
It's actually a little bit more going on in Neptune, but no good apply to that, so a long time.
And technology still remains a high priority. We still need to develop, there's a lot of technology that we still need to develop for future missions, especially with the Titan-Saturn system mission, Neptune orbiter probe into Mars, simple return lander and orbiter. The technology hasn't been developed for those missions yet. So if anything, we need to put money into technology development for those missions as well. Once again, all those missions we just showed you has to fit in that budget. And once again, this was the budget before the Office of Management and Budget came out with its latest figures. So that number is definitely going to increase. Here we see the recommended program.
So this is just a little confusing in there. Basically, if you put all the pieces in that are recommended, here's where they're estimating the funding line runs. Oops. So that's what all the talk about the scoping is. Everything above the line is over the original budget estimate, let alone the new numbers that are coming in a little bit lower. So that's why you go through this process of de-scoping missions. It just doesn't fit the curve.
So if less funding is available, this is NASA's plan. De-scope or delay the flagship missions. Slip to new frontiers and discovery missions. Only adjustments to the flagship missions cannot solve the problems.
So just to be clear, they're saying take the money from the big guys. That's what they're recommending. The National Research Council is saying that's what you should make the cuts. Don't go after the smaller missions and the mid-range missions unless you have to.
And then put the money into research. Technology development.
So preserve that little nut on the side. Jump in and talk about applications. So research analysis, technology discovery and new frontiers. That's what we're trying to protect. That's the recommendation to NASA. Also in the cost for the Mars mission, they also want to talk about partnerships. So get the money down to $2.5 billion for NASA's contribution. You're working with the European Space Agency, so let's see what we can do in cost share. But they also are very concerned that we don't lose that relationship. So you have to see if you can find that balance. Can we get down $1 billion less on the mission between cuts and sharing the cost with the ESA? Realistic sample return. Don't cut the mission so much that you're going to high risk of possibility of return. You got high risk already. Half of the missions that we have done to Mars, over the time we've been doing Mars exploration, half have failed. So it's already high risk. They're saying don't make the cut so deep that the risk is too high. Again, if that's the situation you're in, slide the whole thing. Okay? So to meet the criteria, then you're going to the Jupiter mission. No recommendation for a plan B for Mars. So fly that city or move on to the next choice. Okay? Again, for the orbiter mission, in terms of being able to make it affordable, if you can't make the cuts, move on to the third priority. They put a $2.7 billion cap on that mission. And if that's not affordable, then that's where they say, okay, go ahead, back to these final choices in the list and getting down to $2.4 billion and $1.9 billion respectively on those missions. So basically, you take the cut as far as you can, if you can't hit those goals and do what you said you were going to do, skim it, push it off to the next decadal survey, and move down the list. Now, one of the things they said in here early on, you may have skipped over that line, there's a little line in there that says, these are our cost recommendations, but we say we should leave out launch vehicle costs. That's not a small thing. Usually in past missions, those budgets included cost of getting you to lower Earth orbit. In Lafayette, that's usually a big part of the bill. But it turns out that those launch vehicle costs are rising. Okay? One of the reasons that they're rising is none of these missions are going up in a shuttle. Right? Shuttles are tiring this year. Okay? So now you've got to be looking at the other launch vehicles, the capabilities that you have, the number of vehicles that are available, so that money is going up. So they're hoping that they can say, look, we'll have a separate line item for launch vehicle costs. Okay? Another big issue, plutonium-238. What's this all about? Well, the amount of plutonium-238 available for spacecraft power is shrinking. Why is this an issue? As a general rule of thumb, it's not completely sure all the time, the general rule of thumb, inter-solar system missions, solar panels, right? Use the sun's energy, right, to sustain the mission, control the power, all that kind of stuff. Outer solar system missions, not enough sunlight, nuclear generation of power. This is not about the controversy of launching a reactor with plutonium-238. That's a separate issue. NASA's taking that for granted and saying, hey, we have to do this, we can do these missions. But we have not been building new commercial reactors in this country, and we've been getting rid of nuclear weapons. So for a while now, we haven't been making plutonium-238. And guess what? We're starting to run out. Okay? So the amount that's available is going down. So this is where the technology development comes in. They say it has to be a priority to have a better system that's going to use less plutonium. And in fact, there is one. There is the advanced Stirling radioisotope generator. Requires much less plutonium, but it is not completely ready to go. They're saying make this a priority, because if you're not able to fly missions on plutonium that you have, if you are dependent on plutonium production restarting, which carries with it all kinds of environmental and political, you know, baggage that goes with that, if you're going to hang your hat on that, you're going to have some big problems. So you've got to find a better way to do it. Interaction with human exploration. So they say, look, if we know the goals that we're picking in these missions, they overlap with the goals that you have for human exploration. If you look at what the Obama administration is talking about, what NASA is talking about, they're talking about the moon, asteroid, Mars, and these moons. Those are all targets for human exploration going forward. They're all targets for planetary science missions. So, obviously, let's work together. Where can costs be saved? Where can we share between? Because we have a separate budget line item for the human exploration. So can we leverage that money to make this work? Supporting NASA activities. That was one of the lines that was in there, was other supporting activities. What are the other kinds of things that the money goes to? Maintaining and upgrading planetary data system capabilities. Educational outreach. This is something that started in the last decade. 1% of each flight project goes to educational outreach activities. We're kind of fond of that. Telescope facilities. The Deep Space Network. If you can't communicate with the vehicles, you might have a problem. Space network can get pretty old. So somebody has to go into that as well. And then curation and laboratory facilities. You bring this stuff back, right? What is the research happen? What are your lab facilities here on the ground to take a look at samples, bring Mars samples back? You better have the ability to analyze those samples here.
And we brought Stardust material back. They had to create a whole new laboratory. They used all new equipment from the medical community to examine these pieces. That was costly. Dollars just to examine and score those Stardust comet samples.
And National Science Foundation. They just want to point out the fact that the other group that uses this report is the National Science Foundation. National Science Foundation is the second biggest funder of planetary research. They use the second biggest chunk of money. So, again, tie in with what's happening with the National Science Foundation, and they make recommendations for what should happen with NSF. They continue NSF support for ground-based observatories, because that's crucial. This has to go hand in hand. The Office of Polar Program Support, important meteorite collections, so there's work that can be done here on the ground. The National Science Foundation contributes to the work that NASA is doing. Funding laboratory research, again, we just talked about laboratory research, NASA funds that as well. They want that to continue, they recommend that. And they recommend a specific telescope project, the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, and this has the potential to make major contributions to planetary science. That's why they take this particular mission out. And they say that timely completion of this, you've got to fund this, you've got to finish this project, because that's going to have an impact on what NASA is doing as well.
And once again, this whole draft is available on the internet, Visions and Voyages, on the Cato Survey website. And when we pass out surveys, when you come back in for the break, and on the surveys, you'll be able to see that website we want to write down.
So, wow, we went way over. I apologize. We still had a couple slides up there. But hopefully that gave you a flavor of what the National Research Council is suggesting. Now, remember, NASA's involved in the process with scientists, but what they want to do now is they want to take this information and craft a specific tailored plan. They will take some of these recommendations, some they will not, and that's what they want to hear from you. What sounds good, what doesn't, what questions do you have, what concerns do you have, and not even just about specific missions, but even about overall budget. So, as Dan said, we'll take a break, when you come back, we'll do some Q&A while you work on the survey forms. It has other information on it, and we'll collect that from you back then.
Okay? Thank you.